This is PGI. Please stand by. We're about to begin. Good morning and thank you for joining the Hospice New Zealand Palliative Care Lecture Series. Our thanks to Genesis Oncology Trust for their continued sponsorship, which allows us to bring you these lectures. Please be advised that today's call is being recorded, the 2nd of July, 2015. I would like to turn the conference over to your speaker today, Dr. Kate Grundy, Clinical Director of the Canterbury Integrated Palliative Care Services. Welcome, Kate. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you very much for the invitation to speak today. I've been asked to share my experiences of caring for patients and families following a diagnosis of motor neuron disease. If you can move on to slide two, I'm going to start with a bit of an overview of the motor neuron disease service in Canterbury, which started with a project around health pathways, which I'll explain to those of you who are unfamiliar with health pathways, initially started as a Canterbury District Health Board initiative. We also now have the benefit of a full-time motor neuron disease coordinator, and I'll tell you a little bit about her role and how that was established. I will then talk a little bit about what motor neuron disease is and illustrate that with with three short case vignettes. I'll then look at a few of the hot topics around motor neuron disease, a little bit about the role of the multidisciplinary team and where palliative care fit into that. I'll finish with giving a sense of what a good outcome might be for these patients for whom it is an utterly devastating illness with many, many challenges, and touch on how we can improve quality of life even in the context of deteriorating function. So hopefully you'll be glad to hear that this is not a tutorial on the clinical management of motor neuron disease, but what I will do hopefully is to encourage you to reflect on your own practice, and for those of you working in palliative care services, to look at how you might develop new ways of working collaboratively with other people managing these patients. And if you have any tips or suggestions for me, then please feel able to share those at the end of the session. So please move on to slide three. So where did things start for me? I certainly have had an interest in motor neuron disease for a long time, and I established the Christchurch Hospital Palliative Care Service back in 1999, and at that stage, motor neuron disease referrals were relatively infrequent, and they were usually heralded by some kind of crisis for those patients coming into hospital. We were aware that patients were also occasional users of hospice services, mainly, I think, around end-of-life care, although I don't have a strong recollection of how things were back in those days. Gradually, I developed a sense of increasing expertise in the area, especially when I developed a particular interest around advanced care planning, which was about 2006-2007. I had received a couple of referrals at that time from patients who had a very strong sense that they wanted to have a voice around future care and end-of-life care. And these one particular lady was very conscious of the fact she was going to be going to lose her ability to communicate as she got sicker, and she wanted to be able to tell her family what she wanted. And for me to be able to facilitate that was an enormous privilege, and was very important for her and very important for her family. Around this time, I began working collaboratively with a respiratory physician who I still work very closely with, and one particular neurologist with a strong interest in motor neuron disease as well as multiple sclerosis. And we started to meet together and think of ourselves as a bit of a virtual team. We were aware that care was quite fragmented for these patients and that hospital was often a very toxic environment for people to be admitted in, where health professionals had very limited understanding of motor neuron disease, and often these patients have had suboptimal care. We, at that time, were liaising closely with our South Island Motor Neuron Disease Association field officer, and she, again, is still part of our team. We were very aware of the wealth of community allied health interest and expertise. A lot of people out there working with patients in the community with a real passion to provide better care. And we came together occasionally, our group of three, and we spent some time imagining how much better things could be if only our ideas could be realized. Motor neuron disease admissions at that time were we started to try and formalize an arrangement where the MND patients were admitted mainly to the respiratory ward, even if they were being admitted for a PEG tube insertion. And that was an attempt to build expertise in one location. And that has been effective and still is in place today. Move on, please, to slide 4. Health Pathways is well known across the South Island. It started in the CDHB, and it's one of the streams of work within an entity called the Canterbury Initiative. The motto for the Canterbury Initiative is working together at the primary-secondary interface, and it's really a perfect opportunity for patients with MND where complex care occurs predominantly in the community. We decided to ask for, this is our group of three again, put a proposal to the Canterbury Initiative to have a health pathway developed around motor neuron disease. And that was established in 2011, and we had obviously palliative care, respiratory, neurology, the field officer, a general practitioner, older person's health, and a really good group of allied health professionals came together. And this was facilitated by the Canterbury Initiative, and there was incredible energy on that group right from the onset, with lots of views and opinions. And we developed a pathway which everyone was really comfortable with, and it went live in October 2012. And it was separated into the issues around making a diagnosis of motor neuron disease, symptom management, and end-stage disease. And there was also referral information to the relevant services such as allied health, respiratory department, genetic testing, etc. So the next three slides are just some screenshots of the Health Pathways site. And as you'll see down the left, there are all the different health pathways. And people will be interested to know we do have a palliative care health pathway. We have one for advanced care planning, which was developed later. We have one for end-stage COPD and for end-stage cardiac failure, all of which have been developed in conjunction with palliative care as a service. But focusing particularly on motor neuron disease, obviously it lives in the neurological section, but part of that is around looking at symptom control, and the full list of symptoms are on slide 6, including obviously a little box that you can open around end stage or advanced motor neuron disease. And this is one of the particular areas, which is dyspnea and MND, giving a bit of a guide for GPs and other health professionals as to how to manage those symptoms. These pathways really serve mainly to consolidate and articulate best practice at the expert level. So the people that come together bring together their expertise and iron out the little differences that exist between the way that key issues are managed and try and find a consensus and write that down. It's funny how writing things down actually brings a closer understanding of what people do and the variance around what people do. But the aim is to empower GPs to become more involved and to know how and when to get help. After all, most GPs will only manage one or two cases of motor neuron disease in their entire career. Moving on now to slide 8. So the clinical caseload for myself around this time was really based around acute admissions referred to the palliative care service in the hospital, and also around clinic appointments within the oncology department, which is where I work, which seems slightly odd, but never really seemed to cause much of a problem for selected patients. And they were, most of them, to be honest, were referred by one particular neurologist in the early stages. I also worked very closely with the hospice and with community palliative care around joint patients, and I've kept stats since 2005. And the last 4 years, we've averaged about 15 referrals per year. In 2001, this is around 2011, around the time that we were establishing the health pathways, Helen Brown, who is the nurse Maud dietitian, has been the nurse Maud dietitian since about 2001. She and I started working together and thinking about developing a clinic, and we set that up at the hospice. And this supported her excellent work with patients, often in advance of a formal community palliative care referral, because Helen is not only the specialist palliative care dietitian, but the nurse Maud dietitian looking after other patients with dietitian and dietetic needs. And by bringing some of these patients to a clinic at the hospice on a monthly basis, it helped to demystify hospice for many patients and families. And it also promoted our integrated model for palliative care in Canterbury, which is where the hospital and the hospice and the community team work very closely together. Since we started that clinic, we've actually seen 86 patients in total since its inception. Moving on now to slide 9. So by 2012, when the health pathway came out, there was a clear case during that process working with the Canterbury Initiative for a coordinator in Canterbury. And it was a wonderful process of bringing together all those health professionals and saying that the missing link here is somebody to bridge the gap and bring together all those areas of specialization. And so Heather Brunton's role was established as a contractor for the CDHB in July 2013. So she's been working nearly for 2 years in that position and covers CDHB, West Coast and South Canterbury. She sees all patients at the time of diagnosis of motor neurone disease, and all neurologists are supportive of this role. And she's had in total 74 referrals to date, of which 34 of those patients have subsequently died. Heather took over, I think, thankfully, very pleasingly to Heather, to Helen Brown, but she took over organizing the hospice motor neurone disease clinic, and she acts as kind of a gatekeeper for that clinic with a good understanding of palliative care and making sure that those patients do have palliative care needs, either physical, psychological, social, as well as a need for that coordinator, coordinated clinic. And so she's able to generate and prompt referrals. Approximately two-thirds, maybe just short of two-thirds of the patients that she has seen have been referred to the clinic, and we have 22 active patients on our clinic list at present. And we have really close liaison with Allied Health, with general practice and with neurology. And one of the things that Heather does is contact each of the Allied Health professionals and also, if necessary, the GP and the neurologist, and brings together that information, that up-to-date information to each clinic for the patients that are booked into the clinic. Evaluations have been extremely positive from the clinic so far, both from Canterbury Initiative, who do evaluation processes independently, but very definitely from patients and families. And she, unfortunately, kind of still works in this isolated role with the Canterbury Initiative, and we're trying to find a permanent clinical home for her, and that's being finalized at the moment. And I think it would be fair to say that Heather, who previously worked in other nursing roles, starting in oncology and working in other roles, hadn't worked in MND before and has had a very steep learning curve, but she's learnt very, very quickly and is highly effective in that role. Moving on to now slide 10. So what is motor neurone disease? It's often We often use the term ALS or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, and they're very closely aligned. But it's a condition that's been described, was first described in the mid-1800s. And it is not a single disease entity. It is actually best considered as a syndrome because of the wide variety of the ways that it presents and the disease trajectory. There has been a huge improvement in understanding of MND over the last 15 years, and one of the things that's become obvious is that there's an overlap with the clinical spectrum of frontotemporal dysfunction or dementia, which highlights a possible pathology, and it also impacts on prognosis. It is characterized by progressive weakness of the limbs, but also the bulbar muscles and the respiratory muscles due to loss of upper and lower motor neuron function. It has a prevalence of 6 to 7 per 100,000. So it's not common, but it's not very, very rare. We see plenty of cases per year, and survival is poor, approximately 2 to 5 years following diagnosis. People will have heard of riluzole, and this confers modest benefit only, and the effect on quality of life is actually largely unknown. About 20 years ago, they discovered that a dominant mutation of the SOD1 gene accounts for about 15% of familial cases. But since then, over 100 distinct SOD1 mutations have been identified with a huge variability in phenotype. And by that, I mean the way that the disease manifests itself clinically. And also, it's become obvious that approximately 2/3 of familial MND cases and about 10% of sporadic actually have a genetic mutation, which is highly interesting and will kind of lead, I'm sure, to much more knowledge about the MND syndrome going forward. Moving on now to slide 11. So thinking now about the interface between palliative care and MND, and I mean the reality is that patients have often had symptoms for quite a long time before the diagnosis is confirmed. And so it's for some patients a feared and often a long-awaited diagnosis. The neurologists need to be really sure that that's what the diagnosis is. And often people have consulted the internet and found out lots of the details of MND before that diagnosis is confirmed. And they can be already significantly disabled. Physical symptoms are extremely common, and they're all outlined on that slide. Interestingly, pathological laughing and crying can be one of the hardest things for health professionals and also families to get used to and to come to terms with, and can be very distressing for patients. Holistic care is absolutely paramount from the word go. Psychological, social concerns are huge, and family support is really critical to providing a really joined-up support for these patients. And the focus absolutely is on living with and not dying from MND. Everything that we do is focused on trying to make the lived experience of MND as good as it can possibly be. Moving on now to slide 12. This is a slide that I've used for a long time. As you can see, it's a very old slide, and it's around the prevalence of symptoms on hospice admission for patients with MND. And as you can see, particularly striking around pain, insomnia, and constipation, which is higher than those patients with cancer. And I'll come back and talk a bit more about those issues, particularly pain and constipation, a little bit later. Moving on now to slide 13. I'm going to just share with you three brief case vignettes, which will hopefully reveal a little bit about the variability of presentation and disease course. We'll show a little bit about the complex interface between many healthcare professionals. And for me, they demonstrate to me my accumulated experience over time, and it's looking back on cases that remind me of some of my thinking around that time and what I've learned. And also this very striking issue of being prepared for the unexpected, of knowing how the disease may manifest itself, the types of problems that may develop over time, helps us to prepare ourselves and prepare families for what might come in the future. Okay, so slide 14 is my first case, which is a young man called Dean, who, aged 44, was diagnosed with MND. He lived with a flatmate at that time, didn't have a partner, but had very supportive parents. And Dean sticks in my mind because he was a bit of an alternative type, a bit of a cruiser, had wonderful dreadlocks and a really cheeky smile. He was very engaging. And he was first referred to secondary care for a respiratory review because he had probable asthma and he had breathlessness and respiratory symptoms. No one was entirely sure, and that was the diagnosis at that time, but only a month later, a neurology review picked up on his cramps, his spasm, a little bit of drooling, and unintentional weight loss, and they raised the probability of MND at that stage. Within quite a short time, he needed to come into hospital for a PEG insertion to try and address the issue of his weight loss and his difficulty with his eating. He very much downplayed his respiratory symptoms and unfortunately went into florid respiratory failure post-sedation for the PEG insertion. It was when he was ventilated on intensive care that I first met Dean, and we successfully brought him back to the ward and tried to help him and his family come to terms with the fact that he would need to be maintained on BiPAP. So it was a massive thing for him. Not only did he leave with a PEG tube, but also with a BiPAP machine. And he had a few failed discharges, and ultimately a friend chose to become his full-time carer. Interestingly, this friend's sister had died of cancer while he was in his teens, and I think that's why he had such a connection with Dean and a connection with that caring role, and it was very humbling to see this friend care for Dean in that way. Unfortunately, his care needs escalated and he couldn't really be looked after at home. And age 44, Dean needed to go into a hospital level care facility in the following year. He did really well. There he actually flourished for a while, but ultimately requested withdrawal from his BiPAP a few months later. And he died peacefully within 24 hours of the BiPAP being removed. Community palliative care were involved in that period of time, and that I think was a very good outcome for him, considering his rapid disease course. Moving on now to my next case, which is a woman called Tui, and this is a very recent case. Tui was age 67 at her diagnosis and had led an extremely rich and active life. She did, though, have a family history of frontotemporal dementia, which has this strong association with MND, so had already some very strong feelings around the diagnosis. She was happily married with two children from a previous marriage, and Tui is her real name, and her now widower has given permission for me to talk about Tui and to use her name. She was diagnosed in October 2013 and was referred to the Motor Neurone Disease Clinic last April, predominantly for advanced care planning and psychological support, because she had a very strong view of her support of a sister dying and her intention to withdraw from treatment in future at a time of her choosing. And this was causing a great deal of distress within her family and her GP and her neurologist. And we spent some time getting to know her, to understand her point of view, to help her with her decision making. And ultimately she did agree to have a PEG tube inserted, but unfortunately it was complicated by bowel perforation and she had a really terrible time in hospital for a couple of weeks. And it was a good illustration of how important it was for me to have had a relationship with Tui before this, because I was able to help with that time in the gastro ward when she was very unwell. And we transitioned her back into the community where she struggled with constipation, but gradually those things settled down. Her journey was absolutely characterized by enormous courage, by a lot of humour. She was an amazing person, and honesty and respect for her views, her decisions. She was actually not doing too badly, and we'd got control finally of her constipation, and she was looking a little bit better, but certainly very weak, very fatigued, and out of the blue she requested to be allowed to stop eating and drinking. It was quite a confronting issue for the her healthcare team, but we spent a lot of time talking to her about how that might happen, supporting her family, making sure she had enough care in place, and she did stop eating and drinking of her own accord. Absolutely on one day. So all food and fluids down her PEG tubes ceased, and she deteriorated quite quickly at home, a little more quickly than we had anticipated, but a lot of support from her community carers and her family, and she died at home within a week. And that is quite a recent case. Moving on now to slide 16, and this is an ongoing case for me, but I've known Mary since 2007. So a long, long time, which is relatively unusual for people working in palliative care. She was diagnosed 2 years earlier, and at the time I saw her in clinic, she was still able to walk with a stick, but she was increasingly using a wheelchair, and she felt quite hopeless, and she did feel like giving up right back at that stage in 2007. One of the things I remember very clearly about Mary was that she was determined never to have strangers in her house. She was married with 4 children, three of those children were still living at home. She had no grandchildren at that stage, and fascinating to know now she has 6 grandchildren, and she has such a lot to do with those grandchildren. She also had a very strong faith, and one of the things that she did very, very early on in my time of knowing Mary was she and her husband went to Lourdes in Paris, that was a huge effort for her to go there. Mary's had many, many hurdles to overcome since I've known her, one of them being respiratory failure, requiring ultimately a tracheostomy because of a lot of respiratory secretions. She's now fully ventilated at home. One of the big problems that she had was that her tracheostomy site took a long time to epithelialize, and her trachea changes were enormously frightening for not just for her and for her husband, but for the trachea nurse and for me, who watched those in ENT outpatients taking one trachea tube out and trying to get the other one to go back in down the track. I think people might be having some sense of what a terrible problem that was, knowing that unless we got it back in again, we couldn't reestablish a ventilation. So it required an enormous amount of trust for Mary for us to help her with that. She has a PEG tube, she has a suprapubic catheter. Last year, she was admitted with cholecystitis and gallbladder necrosis. For people who understand CRP, hers is 375. I honestly didn't think she would survive, but she did. She has an enormous will to live, which is interesting, seeing that so many years earlier she felt like giving up. She's still able to go on a yearly family holiday to Wanaka, and one time I actually bumped into her husband Vinny in New World in Wanaka, and they were there on holiday. That was a few years ago, and it was fantastic to catch up with him. At the last appointment, we have started to really talk about end-of-life care planning, about how that might look. Vinny needs much more help and support at home now than he did, and things are getting more difficult. She's accepted that she needs to go into respite from time to time to give Vinny a rest. And as you'll probably expect, we did manage to get a lot of carers and strangers. Of course, they are now no longer strangers in her home, and Mary has accepted them into her home very graciously, and they're helping her to stay at home for as long as possible. Okay, so I'm going to move on to slide 17 and slide 18, which are really just giving you a glimpse of the enormous number of people who are involved in the care of patients with MND. And all of those on the left-hand side will be pretty obvious, including those agencies like Lifelinks and Enable. And to be honest, you need a social worker or a needs assessor to help you navigate those agencies and make sure that you have everything that you're entitled to. Individualized funding is now much more common, particularly with the younger patients, and works really well, which is where the patient themselves works out what they need and how that money is best best spent, and they do need help and assistance with that. And slide 18 is all the other people that need to be involved, and they are huge. And I'm sure, and I apologize now if I've missed anyone, but there are a lot of different agencies involved. Assistive technology is really important. We often need to use sleep technicians, the tracheostomy, the ENT nurse, dentists, orthotics. And obviously, I haven't put us down there at the bottom because of any other reason, just to say that obviously we need to make sure that if we're going to be involved from specialist palliative care, we need to add value. We need to be needed. But also we need to make sure that referrals to specialist care, palliative care are done in a timely way so that relationships can be built and that that help can be there when it's needed and not left until the very last minute. And that really does take, I think, quite a lot of care to do that in a timely way. Okay, moving now on to slide 19. I'm just going to just introduce you to this idea of specialist palliative care and its involvement with MND. This is a survey, a relatively recent survey from the UK, and it's clear that the majority of specialist palliative care services in the UK are involved with MND, and I'm sure that's the same in New Zealand, but it is often only in the terminal stages, and major decisions, re-interventions have already occurred in many cases. And interestingly, involvement seems to be reducing over time, and I'm not sure exactly the reason for that. Many palliative care consultants, however, have limited knowledge about what the interventions are likely to achieve, both in quantity and quality of life, because those decisions are made elsewhere. Different physicians indicated in this survey that there was a lot of contact between the specialties, but limited understanding of what each other's roles were. And I think that's one of the things that we've managed to achieve really well in Canterbury, is a really strong sense of what each other has to offer. So what it was clear that achieving appropriate holistic care was absolutely using the appropriate interventions was the ideal, with the overall aim of maintaining quality of life despite disease progression. Moving on now to slide 20. So what affects the disease course of MND? There are four main things: nutritional care, respiratory care, presence or absence, and then, of course, the management of frontotemporal dementia, and also the issue of multidisciplinary support. There is a lot of evidence to say that MDT support improves survival. And when I mean it, I'm talking MDT, I mean, I'd like to think that every MDT was an IDT, but given so many people involved, that's a real, it takes a lot of effort to create a true IDT with so many people involved, but that is obviously the ideal. The MDT needs to be coordinated and the input needs to be complementary. We need to try and reduce the burden of too many people involved that are unnecessary, of people having to share their story and repeat, and also having to kind of navigate all the different people that are involved. I think that that telemedicine has a lot to offer and can help with this MDT support, and we're using that increasingly in Christchurch, particularly for people in outside areas such as South Canterbury and the West Coast. And often we can draw in critical MDT people, nurses, allied health, into those meetings if needed. Moving on now to slide 21. So I'm going to touch first on nutritional care. And inadequate nutrition and weight loss are really common in MND, and if present, they shorten survival. So dysphagia is obviously an obvious cause, as is impaired motor function, so the swallowing, the act of eating, but also of active feeding, of actually putting food from the plate into the mouth. If you can't use your hands, it's difficult to feed yourself. There is also a sense that that MND is also a hypermetabolic state, which doesn't help things either. So there are a lot of interventions, starting with dietary input, making sure that food is of correct consistency, that there's sufficient calorie content, and that people are able to maintain hydration. There's then a huge role for occupational therapy, making sure that the correct utensils and home modifications are in place so that we can maximize function even with deteriorating deteriorating strength. Physio also has a huge role with strength maintenance, things like seating and ensuring full range of movement or maximized range of movement. Social worker with financial support, making sure sufficient carers are there at the right time of day, and also improving emotional health as much as possible to try and help people feel positive about their nutrition and about their care in general. Respiratory function also has a huge impact on nutritional care, making sure there's adequate ventilation and secretion management. I'm not going to talk a lot about Botox because I don't have time to cover that, but botulinum toxin injections to reduce secretions are a key role, and we probably a couple of times a year will refer through to our Botox clinic in the CDHB. There are no large studies, but overall it is accepted that the combination of all relevant interventions above do improve both quality and quantity of life. A little tip, I think it's really important to actively inquire the patient and family as to the burden of oral feeding, because this happens incrementally over time, and sometimes it can be well over an hour for a patient to eat a small amount of food. They're absolutely determined to keep eating, but the act of eating takes up an enormous time of the day and becomes a huge chore, a huge burden, a huge problem to the patient and the family. And if that's the case, getting in early with PEG feeding doesn't stop them from still participating in the family meals, but it means that they don't have to rely on their whole nutrition from what they can actually eat normally. Moving now on to slide 22, just a little bit about PEGs and RIGs. RIGs are radiologically inserted gastrostomy tubes. And we need to ideally encourage joint patient and family education from, we call them a PEG nurse and a dietitian, and to address dietary issues, feeding regimes, because there are different ways of administering feeds via a PEG tube. It's really important to consider before patients lose too much respiratory function, if we think back to Dean, and generally accept that an forced vital capacity of less than 50% makes it dangerous to sedate and put in a PEG tube. So as I mentioned before, ideally commencing as a supplement rather than a full feed. And RIGs are safer to insert with reduced respiratory function, but they tend to be less satisfactory. And people will probably have heard of this. There's no evidence that PEGs improve survival, but it's about the fact that they don't improve survival on their own. So many other things are done to improve outcomes nutritionally, and PEGs are only one of those interventions. And they do come with risks, and a person needs to understand, and the families need to understand that. Sometimes we obviously have to manage nutrition without a PEG because the patient doesn't want that, and that's absolutely fine, but it takes quite a lot of expertise just to work around that, and again going back to the dietitian and the OT predominantly. PEGs do allow medication delivery and hydration, so it's not just about food. And one of the things that we often emphasize is that hydration is just as important, and it doesn't mean being fully fed until right at the end. And that's one of the things that people are very fearful of, is that once they've been started on a regime, that will continue even when their quality of life is gone. And you need to make sure that that's talked about proactively right from the word go. Okay, moving on to respiratory care. Breathlessness is extremely common in MND, and management improves quality of life and minimizes hospital admissions. Sialorrhea, which is drooling, affects breathing, and we need to address this fear of patients kind of drowning in their own secretions, and it really doesn't happen when it's managed well. Opioids titrated will improve quality of life, and we need to educate people preemptively. And overnight pulse oximetry is commonly used. We don't tend to use the SNP, but that is used in other centers. And respiratory failure can develop insidiously or acutely. non-invasive ventilation does improve both quality and quantity of life. Now, the second bullet point, I've got slightly the wrong way around because, and that's just an error, median survival is a great deal longer in the subgroup of people who have less bulb of dysfunction. So that's part of how we identify the right people to be introduced to non-invasive ventilation, which is BiPAP. Because if they've got a lot of bulbar dysfunction, they're less likely to tolerate and to get benefit from NIV. When we start people on BiPAP, we need to also think about how things might progress with increasing need for BiPAP, not just overnight, which is where the main problems develop, but increasingly during the daytime and potentially advancing to full-time ventilation, and how we might be able to address withdrawal of ventilation when needed. And those things, those conversations are need to happen in advance at an appropriate time. The cases where we've stopped, sometimes we can withdraw ventilation at the end of life extremely easily with opioids and benzodiazepines, and sometimes it's incredibly challenging. And these cases can stay with us for a long time. I remember a case over on the West Coast where I had almost hourly conversations with a GP in Buller Hospital when a lady who was very, very frightened needed to come off her BiPAP at the end of life. She wanted to stop the BiPAP, but needed an awful lot of support to do that. That GP was amazing, and as were the family and the staff. A brief mention of frontotemporal dementia. It needs a whole session on itself, but it's very common, and people will be aware of personality changes in some patients, irritability, executive dysfunction, and this issue of poor levels of empathy, people just becoming very self-centered about their own issues. And we sometimes see that and see how difficult that is for families to deal with as well as for health professionals. And interestingly, there's a marked reduction in survival in these patients. And we know that they survive less well, partly because they don't comply so well with treatment, particularly with NIV. Now, we don't undertake routine testing of frontotemporal dementia, and I'd be interested if any other centers are doing that. It's quite time-intensive, and it's quite a sensitive thing to raise with families and with patients about testing for dementia. Just briefly now on slide 26 about the allied health team and palliative care. We work so closely with our allied health team, and there's a lot that they can give us, and there's a lot that we can give them, and it's a real privilege to work with them. I try to copy them on my letters, and I help them with funding applications. I also think that that working together helps to encourage innovation and perseverance, because I know that it's the little things that can make the difference with patients. Just helping with their pain, cramps, spasticity, making sure we've got the right aids, we've got the right comfort measures, we've got the right seating, we've got the right bedding. Overnight pain is often a big problem for patients, and getting the mattress right is really important. So the support measures are really crucial, not just about medicines. Constipation, I think, is a massive problem, very underappreciated. And these are some of the, this is now on slide 28, some of the multiple causes. Often patients will reduce their fluids unintentionally because it's such a chore getting to the loo. And in doing so, they become dehydrated and constipated. Getting to the toilet, relying on other people, the privacy concerns, even just getting into the correct position on the toilet. And then we sometimes use anticholinergic agents, and no wonder our patients are not keen on having opioids, because they just compound the problem of constipation. So my approach is to name the problem, be upfront about it, and patients say, gosh, you know, I didn't realize that this was part of the MND. Address the easy stuff, get them on laxatives, get their toileting hygiene sorted out, and consider a community nursing referral, because it may be helped with regular scheduling of rectal interventions. Okay, now the little picture on the right-hand side is a lovely patient of mine called Ben, who had his son following his diagnosis of MND. He's got an amazing wife. That's him in the hospice at the clinic with a lovely box of Nutritious on his knee. And he's one of our younger patients, and that is a huge challenge, how we care for those patients. Again, advanced care planning is a separate talk on itself, but I think it's everybody's role. It's the best person to do the job. It's important not to be too specific when we talk about advanced care planning right at the beginning, because sometimes people have no idea how the disease is going to pan out. Even if there isn't an ACP, we need to be really clear about things like ventilatory support and getting in touch with the ambulance, for example, to make sure that they know what the patient's views are about ventilatory support if they were to deteriorate at home. Another huge challenge is around bureaucracy and delays, and that can be a massive issue for families. And if people have particular questions about that, I'd be happy to help and give you some of our insights. Respite, I think, again, is another real pressure point, because these patients have complex needs, and I'm sure you've all heard many times from families that no one does it as well as we do. No one cares for the patient as well as the family do, and seeing patients be looked after differently in care, either in hospital or in aged care or even in hospice, can be very distressing. And when we think about hospice and aged care, which are the best places for respite? They're quite they're intensive resource patients, and it can be quite difficult. In hospice, often the carers can come in and help, and that can be a big advantage. It's not so easy in aged care. Families are often struggle with this idea of burden versus duty. They so want to continue to care, but it's so hard, and they need our support to maximize their ability to do that in the long term. So what's a good outcome for patients? Clearly survival, strength, maintaining function, and this sense of well-being, and well-being means different things in different people, and amazingly well-being and quality of life can be maintained right through major deteriorating functional levels. And it's a sense of the response shift in quality of life. It isn't automatic that quality of life reduces as function reduces, and patients have this amazing ability to recalibrate and reconceptualize their care. For us, this idea of keeping one step ahead, knowing what's going on, that's about expertise. And I love this quote from a recent paper from Australia about bespoke communication with patients and families, but also with the care team. And being able to manage complexity and change requires trust in order to plan. I think that our patients are an amazing illustration of the strength of the human spirit, and it's why they're such an amazing group of patients to work with. My very last slide is a little quote from a patient of mine who saw on video conference. He's in from South Canterbury, and he sent me this picture as a moment of light relief. And the picture is significant because, unfortunately, that Mo had to go because it affected the seal on his BiPAP mask. So I think that's quite a fitting way to end, and hopefully there is at least some time for some questions.